So we're going to talk about the dog, right? And then it starts out really broad, and then we go narrower and narrower and narrower and narrower. And then by the time you get to other courses besides the foundation course, we're talking about specific behaviors and how to handle specific behaviors. So we do start off pretty broad here. Did you take the evaluations course? Yeah, so that was very, very specific about what you do in a shelter or a rescue environment, how you evaluate what you do with the actual animals and how you predict their behavior. So we're probably going to touch on that a little bit in this upcoming 6 weeks. We'll touch on everything. So we'll touch on all the emotions and all that kind of stuff. And then if you find that this is not enough and that you're an addict like the rest of us, then you end up, you know, being able to do more. I actually had people crying last time when we ended up because people had finished their whole year, and you know. So, okay. So this is ethology. Ethology is the study of a dog or an animal in its own environment, and for our purposes, a dog is in its own environment here, in our world. But they did start off as being other animals, so we're going to start off with that and just kind of narrow it down to dogs. Some of these pictures are from Wolf Park in Indiana. If you've never been to Wolf Park and you get a chance, go. It's really fascinating. It is Dr. Eric Klinghammer was the one who formed it years ago. My daughter and I went there for a three-day seminar. And it was just really cool. You get to meet wolves. You get to sit with wolves, and they are not tame. They are definitely not tame. So you have to be very careful in how you handle them. But it really is great because you see a lot of doggy behaviors, and you're like, okay, this is where this stuff came from. It's fascinating. They actually do a week-long seminar, or they used to. I hope they still do, on dogs versus wolves. The differences and similarities, which is kind of cool too. So is a dog a wolf? There's actually, I don't know how much reading you guys do, but there's actually kind of a lot of controversy about this. Not that they didn't come from wolves, because they did come from wolves, but you know, in our society and over the last many years, people have always said, oh yeah, well, you know, there's wolf packs and that's why dogs have dog packs and all that kind of stuff. And there are controversies in as much as, do we act like primitive people? You know, do dogs act like wolves? Do we act like primitive people? So we'll address a little bit of that. We do know that dogs are directly descended from wolves, so they share the same DNA, they can intermate. You can get wolf dogs, and people really like that. I ever met anybody who's got a hybrid who thinks that's very cool? Then they discover that they can't keep them enclosed. The animals continually destroy everything. And you can't house train them very well. There's a bunch of things that happen if you've got more than half wolf. But we know that they did come from wolves. They can interbreed with wolves just like they can interbreed with coyotes. So wolves versus dogs. Wolves are tribal. So a wolf pack is a big family. It is not a It's not a conglomerate. The alpha pair, if you will, are the mother and father who have puppies, who then have puppies. So there might be 3 to 4 generations of wolves in a wolf pack. Depending on all kinds of things, that wolf pack can extend up to about 30 animals. And that's usually about as big as they get. But it can all go all the way down to just a mom, dad, and litter as well. And I'm going to have a little bit of video here from David Meach in a few minutes on the whole alpha thing. So dogs are also tribal. Dogs accept people into the tribe. In fact, they actually prefer people if left to themselves, which is kind of interesting. It's especially interesting because, and you'll hear me talk about this again, what we do is we take puppies from their moms at about 8 weeks, and then we shove them back with a whole bunch of other dogs when they're 3 months. or 4 months or whatever, which is not necessarily a good idea. Now, at Wolf Park, what they do is they take the puppies, I think at 3 to 4 weeks, really young, and they handle them. And then they take them back and give them back to their moms at 8 to 10 weeks so that they can actually go in the enclosures. Because otherwise, they would have wolves that didn't want to socialize with people at all. So the puppies in a wolf life, in the wolf life, are a progeny of just the alpha pair. So they are, you know, that the mom and dad are the ones that have all the litters of puppies, and where in the dog world, they're the result of two adults, but they're raised by the dam only. So in the wolf world, they're raised by the whole pack. In the dog world, they're raised by one only. Hierarchy, just the mom. The hierarchy is very common. It's very normal. It's how we can keep our dogs living with us. And it's necessary if you're going to raise a family properly. You have to have respect for parents. Because if you don't have respect for parents, then the puppies would do whatever they wanted to do. And that wouldn't lead to success in the wild. If somebody's going, okay, we're going to hunt that. And somebody else goes, no, let's hunt that. No, let's hunt that. Now all of a sudden you don't have anything that's being hunted, and so everybody will starve to death. So it is really important to have a good, stable leadership, a hierarchy in the wolf world. It's also very important for us to have a very stable leadership in the dog world. And there is a tremendous amount of misunderstanding about what good leadership is. All the way from, you know, people who are kind of what we think of as traditional dog trainers to people who don't think there is such a thing as hierarchy. And by the way, there are people who think that. There are people who, particularly it's the scientific world, who just throw that away because they say there's not been any proof of it. Personally, I think there has been proof, but that's kind of what they say. So the hierarchy is, if it's stable, if it's good, it's held in place by tradition, you know, who used to be who has always been the leader or whatever, and resource control, which I'll talk a lot more about, and also by what's called ritualized affection and aggression. So there are all kinds of things about wolves and dogs, for that matter, that are ritualized. And we see this all the time. If you work in daycare, you're going to see a lot of ritualized behavior, where one dog will do one thing, another dog will do something else. They have now just been pretty plain with each other about, you know, what's going on in the dog world. And you were talking earlier about your dog is picky. Your dog is probably giving off signals that you haven't really noticed. Actually, that happened to me today. We have a little Chihuahua. This is Aspen, by the way, who is the princess of the universe. And she is 7 years old. We raised her from the day she was born because we had her mama in for, she came into the Marine Humane Society, and then we took the pups and raised them, and then they all went back up for adoption, except we kept Aspen. We did not keep her mother because we did not want a barker dog. Guess what we got? You don't. She says, I do. It's really important. I have to tell everybody what everything's happening all the time. She doesn't bark in here, which is really good. That's why I can bring her. But we also, one of our other dogs is a Chihuahua. And the Chihuahua is she was a mom dog when we were working in Santa Cruz. She was a mom dog who came in with her puppies. She was owned by a homeless woman. And I still cannot imagine being a homeless woman with like 5 dogs. All of which were pregnant, by the way. So they all had puppies. The puppies and the pups were fostered out. We didn't foster that particular litter. And then the moms went up for adoption as well as the puppies. Puppies get adopted like that. That's what happens. But Flaca, our dog, bit everybody. She didn't like anyone, so if you tried to handle her, she'd bite you. And then she fell in love with my partner, Trisha. And she suddenly became ours. So yet another failed foster. So we have 4 failed fosters. We have Luke, the pit mix, pit Akita mix. We've got 3 little ones, including another mom dog. So So what happens with Flocka, Flocka's really scared of people. And when we have successfully taught her to just walk by people, she has certain people that she likes as friends, most people she doesn't want to have anything to do with. And today, this has not happened very often now, and since we've had her, but today I was stopping putting the leashes on the dogs because we were coming out of open space land, and somebody walked by and Flocka went at them. And I'm like, damn, you know, trying to figure out what I did, what was happening that I didn't notice over the last, because it doesn't happen very often. So I have to figure out what happened the last time it happened, what had happened the time before that. And I finally figured it out. What happens is if I am stopped on a trail and I'm not paying attention to her, or not actually paying attention, then that's when she does this. So this is the kind of stuff we're talking about, okay? Is, you know, what does the body language do? What are they telling us that we don't know that they're telling us, you know, because we're just two stupid human beings. I did a consult yesterday with somebody. I can't remember who they were. They had, this is what I do, by the way. I do lots of consults. And every week I come in and talk about a consult, and then I get them all mixed up with the other consults. But this one is, it was a small dog, and they finally came, the adults and the family suddenly realized that the dog saw a different world than they did. And it was really good, because here I am talking to these people about their behavior problems, and the dog likes to attack feet. And I said, okay, so the dog is this big. I said, so what does your dog see? And they went, oh my God, feet. So yeah, so looking at what the dog sees, that is a really important consideration. You know, what do they see, what goes on in their head when they act out. An amazing number of people think their dogs act out because they're jerks or because they're doing something to them. This is because we're all egotists. We all think that dogs are, you know, they're talking to us. Hey. Okay, so back onto the wolf pack again. The leader of this pack can be experienced and wise, can be a really good leader, can be benign, can be a jerk, just like in our world. We occasionally have jerks for leaders. So, and the other thing that's interesting about this, the other thing that's interesting about this is that the leaders, they can be overthrown. They absolutely can. So when we were at Wolf Park, there was a wolf, a young wolf. I should probably show a video of her later. She's beautiful, she's black. And she was very young, but very pushy when we saw her. And come to find out that later she became the alpha bitch. But she was a very bad one. And they kicked her out of the pack. So now she has to be separated. They attacked her. The rest of the pack attacked her. And she was kicked out of the, so now she has to be separated. She's not killed. But the previous, I think 3 to 4 years previous, another wolf was actually killed by the pack. And she was a real, anybody seen really bully dogs? You know, dogs that kind of just pick on other dogs in dog parks and stuff like that, and they're real jerks about it. And the other dog is giving all kinds of signals about, oh my God, please don't do this. They flip over, they'll drop their tail down, they do all kinds of stuff, but this one dog is gonna be a jerk. In a wolf pack, that would have been a dog that would be kicked out. In our dog parks, people just say, let them work it out together. I don't agree with that. So everybody's heard about the alpha. It's used not only as the top dog or top wolf in the pack, but it's also used as a basis for certain kinds of training. Most of that training is kind of forcible training. When they talk about alpha thing, I have to say that in my practice, and I see maybe 6 to 8 people a week, a good half of them will say, oh, I'm just not a very good alpha. And, you know, then we come to find out that that has nothing to do with the behavior problem at all. But people want to take all the responsibility to ourselves because we're egotists. Okay, we're always thinking everything's about us. If you asked Aspen if it's about me right now, she'd say, no, it's about her. Because we're all heroes of our own story, so we have to always remember that. So whether you use this as a training tool, that's kind of an open question, and we can talk about it a lot. But whether a wolf pack is led by the alpha is another. And yes, absolutely, there are leader wolves, as we said. So this is a video. This is Dr. David Meech. He was the one who coined the term alpha. And boy, is he sorry. Let's see if I get this.
The term alpha isn't really accurate when describing most of the leaders of wolf packs because the term implies that the wolves fought and competed strongly to get to the top of the pack. In actuality, the way they get there is merely by mating with a member of the opposite sex, producing a bunch of offspring, which are the rest of the pack then, and becoming the natural leaders that way, just like with a pair of humans producing a family. Instead of using the term alpha for a wolf, instead of saying alpha male or alpha female, scientists now tend to call wolves like that the breeding male and the breeding female. And or you can call them the mother wolf and the father wolf. There's really nothing wrong with that. Those are much better and more accurate terms than the term alpha. The term alpha is...
No, you have to say it again. It's okay. Yeah. So he kind of takes care of him.
He'll introduce any new puppy into the pack, and then the rest of them will growl at them until they accept, because the puppy will go too far and invade space, and they'll check him. Mm-hmm. But he can be jerk sometimes, too. He'll find the button, he'll push it.
So he's an individual.
Yeah, I don't want to take away his individuality ever.
No, I mean, you know, they kind of can do this. They can. They're all individual. The way they work out, relationships are all individual. But there are what we think of alpha in a lot of cases are bullies, and they're not alpha. They're usually the most insecure dog. Just the same way as they are in our society, because they are. You know, they're the ones that have to pretend so that they can become, so that others become afraid of them. In a true leadership environment, you don't have to be afraid of the dogs, right? One dog should not be afraid of another dog. They should definitely defer to leaders, but not necessarily be afraid of them.
They'll push them until they draw the line.
Yeah, so and then he draws the line, and then
terrible.
He says, yeah, well, she draws the line all the time, but there's no way that she's a leader dog. She just says, I want to be left alone. I am Spitz. I am tough dog, but she does not want to be a leader. So, you know, there's that, too. You know, how many of you guys want to be president? Maybe now. No. You know, if you don't want to be president, we just want to live our lives. You know, and that's what most animals do. That's what most dogs do. That's what most anything does. We just want to live our lives. So I love this picture. The wolf has got a little bone up here. So anyway, I think it's cute. So what on earth happened? So where did, and again, you can do reams and reams and reams on wolf behavior. It's really fascinating. If you want to be an ethologist, you can certainly do so. The thing about ethology is that it can be really tedious. I used to, you'd be happy about this, I used to have my students do a real ethological study, but I don't anymore because it's too hard. So anyway, what happened? What caused the wolves to become dogs? Because something obviously happened. That does not look like a wolf, you know. Although Eric Klinghammer, the guy who developed Wolf Park, he had chihuahuas and he called them his pocket wolves.
But you can see the wolf in them. I mean, I can see
That's a wolf there.
Oh.
That's a wolf. That's not a wolf, right? I mean, that's a dog. Now, these guys are all wolves. So what happened, the first theory, you know, a long time ago, the theory was that some little cave kids found some wolves, wolf puppies, and raised them, and then they became wolves, and then they became dogs. Well, in order to actually be successful, this would have had to be replicated hundreds and thousands of times, you know, to actually get this kind of thing happening. Has anybody here ever found a baby raccoon or something like that, or tried to raise any kind of? You found a baby raccoon? Some people try to raise them as pets, only to discover that when they're an adult, they are no longer a pet. So raising a puppy wolf is not likely to make this puppy wolf become an adult pet. The puppies can be very, very lovely and whatnot, but the older they get, the more they become wild animals. So another theory is that wolves and people began cooperating. Perhaps, you know, the hunting society, the wolves realized that they were pretty good at chasing, but people were better at killing. I don't know. That's another theory. People could fashion weapons, and wolves had better senses. So that would be very cooperative. I think that Michael Fox, not Michael Fox, the actor, another Michael Fox, he held to that theory, and there are still some people who do that, and I don't necessarily think they're wrong, but again, what seems to have happened worldwide is that dogs domesticated themselves. That appears to have been what happened. Cats domesticated themselves as well. Well, no, cats domesticated us. Yeah, but dogs kind of domesticated themselves. And so the going theory right now is Coppinger's theory. And if you looked at the book list that I put on the web, anybody get to the web to see what we're going? Okay, there's a book list there. Those are books that I'm not going to test you on, but they're very good. And Ray Coppinger's book is one of the best. It's called Dogs, A New Theory. And when he wrote it, about 10 years ago, I think, it was absolutely unknown. I mean, he was the first, as far as I know, he was the first to come out with it. So his theory is that less fearful wolves gather around the perimeter of villages and doing what wolves do best and dogs do best, which is eat stuff, right? So they, you know, they're good at eating. At Wolf Park, when we were there, what they would do is they would get roadkill. People would bring them roadkill, and then they'd throw that in with the wolves so they could have their raw meat. But the wolves themselves didn't kill them. They were already killed by us in cars. Well, you couldn't feed a cat that. You couldn't feed a cougar that. They have to kill their meat. It has to be totally fresh. But wolves and dogs are good about eating things that are riddled with yuck. You know, so they would eat a lot of trash. Also, you know, it's disgusting to think of, but one of our dog's favorite things to eat is human poop. I know, they're not people, are they? You know, so, but that is one of the things that they like to eat. So there, it actually makes this theory kind of hold some water. So what happened is that they kind of would hang around the villages, they would go in, they would eat stuff, and then they would go back out again, which would indicate that they were fairly close in proximity. And if they don't talk about it in this next video, but by the way, did you guys hear this video okay? Was that loud enough for you? Because it's as loud as I can get it, but I can, okay. So what happened was that according to Coppinger and according to the research that he has done, as the animals bred, their appearance changed. So their ears dropped, their coat colors changed, they actually became a different size. Wolves can range up to 160 pounds. Dogs very rarely get to 160 pounds, and if they do, their hearts usually can't handle it very well, and they have short lives. So, on the outskirts of villages, anybody been in places where there are village dogs? Yeah? They're what, about 45 pounds? Just about 45 pounds. Yep. And they usually have prick ears and a long tail and a short coat, depending on where they are. So, I mean, if you go, presumably, if you found any in Norway, it would have a long coat. But certainly most places where they still exist, which would usually include, you know, kind of the equatorial regions, India, there was a cool study that was done in India that I'll probably bring up a little bit later with street dogs, that dogs range from 35 to 45 pounds, which is just the right size to be able to chase down some prey, but at the same time not to need a whole lot of food. So that's kind of where he says. So their appearance change, their coat colors change, etc. So this point of view has been given credibility by a lot of other biologists at this point. So they've been studying what we do when we intervene. You know, when human beings get involved in animals, we do an awful lot to change their genetic structure. All you got to do is look at some of the birds and whatnot, like chickens. They couldn't fly very far away. You know, so once we get involved in them, there's an awful lot of genetic mutation that goes on. So this is a point of view that's now been given a lot of credibility. And the reason I bring it up here in a class about dogs is because it has a huge impact on the way our dogs behave and what we should expect of our dogs in the future or in the present or whatever, okay? So I'm going to come back to that slide in a second. This is a movie about the, where did there, or there? No, it's not here, so okay. So this is, have you heard of the study of Believ? You have, okay. So he, in the 1960s, a long time ago, he actually was studying foxes with an eye to making fur foxes be tamer. So in other words, make them easier to slaughter. So so he started this experiment, and it is still going on to this day. It now has a different kind of a, pardon?
Agenda,
yes, definitely. And they're just doing an awful lot of it. But this is part of it, and this is one of the reasons why Coppinger's theory is now given a lot of credibility.
I really think that the Believ experiments was one of the most significant experiments in evolution that took place in the 20th century. And it affected my life and my thinking in so many ways.
The experiment was begun in the 1950s at a fox farm in Siberia. The foxes were being bred for their fur, but they were wild animals that were hard to handle and often too stressed to breed. Dmitry Believ, a geneticist, was taken on to see if he could develop foxes that would be easier to keep. He began his experiment by breeding together those foxes with the least excitable temperaments. Believ selected foxes by a simple method. He extended a gloved hand into each animal's cage. The foxes that attacked, cowered, or bit him were excluded from breeding. But those that showed tolerance or curiosity were mated together. In effect, Believ was selecting the foxes for their flight distance. The subsequent results were staggering. The new generations of foxes were transformed, not just in behavior, but in their appearance. Within just 10 years, the selected foxes showed new variety in their color. Some were born with mottled coats or black and white patches.
Border foxes.
Their ears became floppy. They started to bark, vocalize. They became highly playful even into adulthood and were no longer afraid of people. Some of the foxes even began to answer to their names. Believ had stumbled across the discovery that selecting for the quality of tameness alone could set off a cascade of other changes. We can still see evidence of this quantum leap at the same research center today.
Up to that point, we all kind of believed Darwin. Darwin said, nature does not go in leaps. Things don't happen. fast. They happen was with Belyaev's experiment. He was wrong. They do go in leaps, and sometimes big leaps, things that you wouldn't expect. The theory is here is that we're dealing with some underlying structure. When we're dealing with tameness, we're dealing with a set of genetics that is producing a characteristic response.
It is not a coincidence that many domesticated animals are black and white. When selection is made for tameness, it impacts on the entire makeup of the animal. Scientists have determined that adrenaline, the fight or flight hormone, and melanin, the skin and fur pigment, are chemically connected, so they change together, as are the neurotransmitters dopamine and noradrenaline, which control behaviors. Affect one system, and there is a domino effect, from color to behaviors. Coppinger's scavenging wolves may have undergone a similar transformation.
When all of a sudden Belyaev did his experiments, it changed the way a lot of us began to think about dogs. People talked about, why did people select dogs to have this coat color or that coat color and so on? Why did people select dogs to bark? And then all of a sudden we realized that those were a bunch of really silly questions, because we could get all of that just by selecting for tameness.
Belyaev had created foxes that looked and behaved like dogs. His experiment suggested that the transformation of the wild wolf into the dog could have happened in the blink of an evolutionary eye. The stage was set for the development
of the dog. So I find that really fascinating. I really do. And if you read Temple Grandin's Animals in Translation, she has a lot on that. But if you think about our domesticated animals other than dogs, like think about cows. What color are they? Black and white and brown and white. Those are the milk cows, and the milk cows are the most tame of the cows. So they're all, and of the cats, the white ones and the black and white ones often tend to be the most tame ones, whereas the ones like Aussie cats, that's not what I'm thinking of. There are a lot of cats that are fairly non-tame. You know, they're pretty hard to handle them and stuff like that. So this has a lot of credibility, and I think that I think it's useful. So essentially, what he proselytizes here is that the dogs are neotenized. Okay, neotenized essentially means that they are made puppy-like. So if you look at a puppy and then you look at an adult dog, and I'm going to have some more on that in just a bit, you'll see that there are a lot of differences in the way the puppies look. All puppies are born with their ears are dropped, and they have kind of little smooshed in faces, and they just look adorable, which is why people can get them, and then they get this adult dog and they go, what did I just get? So that's what a neotenized dog looks like. And again, I'll have some pictures of neotenized dogs in a minute. But not only do they have the appearance of puppies, but they also have the behaviors of juvenile wolves. Barking is a juvenile wolf behavior. It is not an adult wolf behavior. Wolves do what's called orienting barking. So that means that if they're on a hunt, one wolf will bark once in order to tell the other wolves where he is. So they orient bark. And occasionally they will yip, particularly if they're excited about something happening. And they certainly will howl, which many of our dogs don't do, but some of them do. Anybody here had a dog that actually howls when the sirens go off? Yeah. We could do it with our Rottweiler. He would started doing it, and then after a while we could just go, Barney, ooh, and he'd go, ooh. So he would put on a show every time we started doing that. Right now, what we have and what we are seeing a lot more of, and I think it's really relevant to today, is the pariah dogs, the village dogs. They still exist. You know, they still exist all over the world. Most of them are homeless. They live on the outskirts of villages or around garbage dumps. Some of them are going through a process of domestication, and some of them are just the way they are. And so there, and again, there are thousands of them in India, in Indonesia, in parts of South and Central America. There, and if you ask those people, do you own this dog who's lying there on your front doorstep? They go, no, that's a, he just, this is where he stays. This is, they don't own them. They don't think anybody owns dogs, except for they do have this funny thing where they own purebreds, but not the street dogs. It's kind of an interesting thing. Pariah dogs or village dogs fit a different profile than many of what we consider our dogs. First of all, the packs are very loosely formed. They are not tight family structured like wolves. They can and do mate. Females come into season twice a year. Wolves come into season once a year. Can anybody think of a dog that comes into season once a year? Yeah, they're Basenjis, only once a year. And one other breed that I'm missing, can't remember their name right now. But Basenjis are very close to village dogs. They're not that many generations removed. They don't bark, and they don't come into season twice a year. But our dogs all do. So pariah dogs, again, they do, because in the pariah dog world, the name of the game is production. You produce as many puppies as you can, because then you have a good chance of having some of your offspring survive. In the case of a wolf pack, there's one litter a year, period. Because, and all the wolves are vested in those puppies. They want to make absolutely sure those puppies grow up to become members of their community. But in the pariah world, it's not. You know, they figure it's like there's going to be a high rate of death in the puppies, so they just keep on pumping them out. That, by the way, is the same thing that cats do. Cats can produce up to 3 litters a year if the right circumstances prevail, or only one if different circumstances prevail. So if you think of life as being the reason for life is to be, you know, procreate, everybody has their own way of doing it. Pariah dogs or village dogs are slightly afraid of people, but they're social and resilient. You go to a hotel on a beach in Mexico and there's a pariah dog that's out there, and he'll come all the way up to you and maybe allow you to touch him on his head. And that's pretty much it. So you can't catch them, but you certainly, they look friendly. They just aren't friendly, and which is where we're going to get to in a second. There is not very much territorial aggression because they don't have any territories to speak of. They do have territories, but they don't have a lot of resources on those territories that they're trying to protect. Whereas our dogs are extremely territorial. Anybody have a territorial dog here? Most everybody does, even if you don't know you do. If they bark when people go by your car, if they bark in the house when they look out the window, if they are, you know, anything like that, then they're probably quite territorial. The bigger the dog, the more territorial. So how many of you guys have dogs? Okay. And what kind of dogs? Just shout it out.
I've got a Carolina dog.
You have a Carolina dog. Wow. Okay. You've got a village dog.
Cattle dog?
Catahoula. A Catahoula. They're also very close to being a village dog. Not very far away at all. What else?
Min Pin Chihuahua.
They're one of the first domesticated dogs. You don't find very many feral little bitty dogs, because they would be meat. They'd be dead. What you got? What?
Border Collie and Chihuahua.
Border Collie and Chihuahua. Yeah, you know, at the shelters, we always used to say, you know, if you adopt any dog, you get a Chihuahua for free. There are a lot of them right now. What else? What else?
Terrier.
What's that?
Terriers.
A terrier? A terrier mix?
Or a Wheatie.
A Wheatie. Okay.
Maltese.
Maltese.
We
think. little white fluffy dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Little white fluffy dog, yeah.
I have no idea what that little guy is.
Huh? Pitbulls? That's not a pariah dog, for sure. That's a really bred dog, because they have a tendency to grow up and be dog aggressive. About 60% of them do, which is not exactly a good way to survive, to be aggressive. So those are really manufactured dogs, unfortunately. So, and we can talk more about those later. We can talk about all types of breeds later. So
I've had a lot of dogs in my life.
one of the best dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a bully right now. He's a bull terrier.
Uh huh.
He's the sweetest dog.
Yeah.
He's very territorial.
Very territorial? Yeah. I mean, there are, you know, all dogs are individuals. We have a pity. And, you know, he's our second pit bull. So,
my pit bull was aggressive.
Huh?
My pit bull is really aggressive.
It's aggressive.
From birth, pretty much.
Yeah, like, turned on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, as I said, 60%.
Yeah.
Yeah, that means you got a 40% chance of getting a really nice dog. And a 60% chance of getting a really nice dog who's dog aggressive. So that, you know, and then of course you have all the other behavior problems that go along with any dog, which can be fear or anxiety or whatever. Those are everywhere. Because people think that I'm a realist, because this is what I do for a living. And so I'm a realist and I love all dogs, but I know that if I'm going to deal with an Akita, it's going to be difficult. And if I'm going to deal with a German Shepherd, it's going to be a pessimist, you know. They're pretty much sure that anything that can go wrong will go wrong, you know. You know, so there's all, because at any given time I might have, I've got 3 pit bull clients right now. One of them is fear reactive, one of them is just a pussycat, one of them is not. So, you know, they're all individuals. So, the other thing is they'll wait, these village dogs kind of wait for food to appear. They don't necessarily go out of their way looking for food because human beings throw so much away. So they're going to wait for that to happen. It's not that they can't. And by the way, terriers are definitely, definitely killers. They're the ones who really will hunt. And if you've got a terrier, you know it. I've had 4 or 5 Cairn Terriers, and one of them sat beside my washing machine for 5 days waiting for a rat to come out. I just thought she was getting weird. I mean, a dog that just sits and looks at a thing, but finally the rat came out and she got it. Yeah?
Just on the food thing, my Carolina dogs, I live in Oakland, take them to Point Isabel, do not go on the weekends anymore, because they will go to that little cafe and they'll sit and watch.
Sit and watch and wait.
And I have to say, I always had to take cash, because I had to sit and watch too, because they would watch and that right there was not paying attention to that bagel. And they would work together and they would get that.
The dog.
Okay.
And then
I'd have to pull out a 10 and buy someone a bagel.
So they would cooperate to steal food.
It was well worth it, yeah.
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 Yeah, then you say, okay, I'm doing an experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
This is a behavioral experiment and you happen to just be in the way at the time. Yeah. Yeah. That'd be good. Okay, so all right, so whether an animal has a pack or doesn't have a pack, and by the way, this is also very important, wolves, coyotes, and dogs will form packs when they need to, and then they will reduce the pack size when they don't need to. This is a really important thing, that this is resource-driven. This is not, if there is perceived to be a lack of resources, the pack will get smaller. Or if the resources are small. So if you're a wolf pack and you're going to be hunting caribou, those are big animals. They take a lot of hunting. They take a lot of speed. They take a lot of, you know, stamina to be able to go get them. Probably going to have a pretty big pack because you need to be able to either surround the caribou or whatever's, you know, methods that they use to bring the animals down. On the other hand, if you're a coyote and you eat mostly rats and mice and stuff like that, your pack is likely to be 3 to 4 animals or less. And desert coyotes usually don't have any pack at all. They just kind of get together to mate and then that's it. So these things are really important for us because resources are really important to us. When there is a perceived lack of resource, then the pack size is going to get bigger or smaller or bigger or smaller. So if you get a daycare situation, for instance, and there is a toy, I know most daycares do not have toys in their enclosures, because if you get a toy or two in the enclosure and it's perceived as a high-level resource by one or more of the dogs, that's when you get issues. If, on the other hand, you had 4,000 things all over the place, then you would probably not have the same amount of resource guarding. So resources have a huge amount they impact everything in our dogs' lives. And I think it's important for us to remember that. You can talk, but you have to talk louder because I've got some stuff going on here, so it's hard for me to hear. If he's hiding, he's caching. That's called caching, C-A-C-H-I-N-G. And when a dog does that, they're usually saving it for later. So they're, and actually they're very funny when they do that half the time, because our pity mix will do that. He will find, he doesn't want his bully stick, so he goes and hides it in the backyard. And then he sits and stares at it. And if the other dogs kind of wander around, he goes, no, you don't need. So he points out where it is, you know. And by the way, if they take it, he just goes, damn, you know. He doesn't do anything else. But he's run by the girls. Whatever the three little girls want, they get. So it is, I mean, it's really funny, this caching thing. That's what I call a partial instinct. So we have a lot of dogs with partial instincts. They have the instinct to start something, but they don't quite finish it. And there's nothing wrong with it if he's doing that, unless he goes and sits, or she sits in front of it and then guards it from the other dog. In that case, then it's something that you should be addressing. But if he just kind of goes and caches it and then he forgets all about it, it's usually not a big deal. Lukey, our guy, he will cache things inside the couch. You know, he gets it all the way underneath the couch and whatnot. And luckily, both my partner and I are trainers, so we laugh. You know, we think that's funny. Other people don't laugh. So village dogs don't tend to form packs because most of the available food is easily available. It's small and it's of relatively low quality, so it's not like a bunch of bully sticks hanging around, you know. So these are things that, so why form a pack? There's always going to be something else that's there. And then the whole thing, about the size of them, a small body needs is more fuel efficient. Less movement requires less fuel, and village dogs tend to just hang around a lot. And that's what they do. And this study in India that I was talking about, you can, if I can remember the name of the study, I'll put it up for you on the web. But it was a study of almost 2,000 Indian dogs. And you know how we are always looking for stimulation for our dogs? We're going to take them here, going to take them there, going to go for dog walks, going to do this and that. The study showed that that most of the dogs did not move more than about two blocks from they're where they hang out, so probably two blocks from their birth. They spend 90% of their time sleeping and 10% of their time eating, you know, looking for food. Now, mind you, they're probably somewhat, you know, undernourished, so they probably don't have an awful lot of energy. But what we do in trying to give our dogs so much stimulation, sometimes I think we overdo it a little bit. I don't think they need it nearly as much as we think that they need it. Oh, here it is. What?
They yeah. It's true. They stay. It's not the same because they have owners. The dogs run free.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously.
They hang.
Watch out for them in the road.
They're lying in the middle of the road. Hey, yeah.
I see the neighbor dog when he comes out barking. I know it's not good reinforcement, but I just get more treat. I see him.
Then they think that you are reinforcement.
Well, he doesn't bark anymore.
Yeah.
He used to chase my car.
Why do you think that's bad?
Huh?
Why do you think that's bad? You think you're reinforcing barking?
Oh, no, I treat him when I see him now.
Yeah.
But before, he used to just bark and chase our car all the way, any car.
But now you're a good buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you have actually done behavior modification without the owners even knowing it.
I made a pact with him.
Yeah, so yeah, you did good stuff. That was really good. So, anyway, I do use this information, by the way. So one of the people that I dealt with yesterday, they live up in Glen Ellen, and they have a really nice big piece of property, a very nice place. And their dog shakes. They get him in, they take him for walks twice a day, but he gets in the car and starts shaking. So he's so terrified for getting in the car. And how long did it take him to get to know me? It took him about a half an hour to where he'd come up to me and even investigate me. So he's highly, highly fearful dog. And I said, so, and then they walk, they have a busy street they live on, and so they try walking on that, but he's terrified to walk on that. And he's probably 15 pounds, if that, maybe even littler. And I said, so why are you taking him for walks? And they said, well, we're supposed to. And I said, no, there's no rule book that says you must take your dog for walks. There's not a single written thing anywhere. It's not in the Ten Commandments. There's nothing. If you can give your dog enough exercise and stimulation around your house and property, do it. Because you've got a dog that is, they've had him for years and he hasn't changed. And we did talk about some things that they can do to help him. But what they've been doing is they've been overstimulating him in an effort to stimulate him. So instead of being stimulated, he's now a basket case. So they were saying, do you think we need to put him on Prozac? And I'm like, no, I don't think you need to put him on Prozac. In this case, I think what we need to do is actually realize that your individual dog, not that another dog you had would need this, but this individual dog does not need daily walks. And we can do some acclimatization so he can get used to the car, which is going to be fine. You know, it'll take a while to do that. But it is an interesting thing because we're now filled with this, you have to do certain things. It's like half of my clients say things like, do I have to walk the dog on the left? No, not unless you're going to carry your gun on your right, because that's where that came from. Is carry the stuff from hunters and soldiers. Carry your gun on the right, carry the dog on the left. So I don't walk with a gun, so dogs can walk on either side. Whichever one I want is fine. So here are some former village dogs. It's a Telemannian dog. This is still not, I don't think it's a breed. But the Canaan dog is. That's an Israeli village dog. And it is now an AKC breed. So it's now been legitimized, if you want to call it that. That's a Norrbottenspetz dog. Again, not in the AKC, probably in one of the European kennel clubs. And that's a Karelian bear dog, which is in the AKC. And I have had three clients with Karelian bear dogs. Guess what the problems are? They bark a lot. Unfortunately, they bark a great deal. But they also have a tendency to be highly, highly territorial. And they hunt. They hunt anything. So they're a hard dog. They were used apparently. They are currently used supposedly for hunting bear, but I sort of doubt it. So these dogs came from a third world country, and we want them to be breeds so much. So they call them Formosan Mountain Dogs, but they're street dogs. And this one here, I don't think these are movies. No. So that one there, I had a little squeaky mouse, and she hunted that while she was in my office. She had a really good time playing with that. But it is funny, you know, you get these breeds that come in from, these dogs that come in from China or from Taiwan, and people go, oh, it's a Formosan Mountain Dog. Hmm, right. It was found on the street. They don't, you know, it's not a breed. Why do we want it there to be breeds? We all want the dogs to be breeds. So, nowadays we're getting a ton of these things. I think I see at least two a month, which is a lot. Many of them are brought in from Taiwan. Some are brought in, I have one that was brought in from Puerto Rico. A recent one I just saw was brought in from Russia. Looks the same. They look very much the same. They have that kind of Carolina dog look about them. And we need to know what these dogs are capable of, because I'm not going to get into this right now, but there's something called epigenetics, which means that essentially what the mother or grandmother learned during her life is passed on genetically to the puppies. So puppies are not clay. You can't take a puppy at 8 weeks from a street dog and expect it to act like one of our dogs that has been socialized and comes from parents that are socialized, because sometimes it just doesn't happen. So epigenetics is a really important new study. So again, it's something that if you want to look it up, you certainly can. But it's used for human beings as well as for What your grandmother ate had a lot to do with how you behave, which is really scary. So this dog is a dog. Bindi, I think, came from, I can't remember. But she has many of the behaviors that I see of a, yeah?
The screen is moving a little.
Oh, it did, didn't it? Thank you. Oh, it's Aspen. No, it's not. It's my foot. I'll just blame Aspen. What the heck? Why not? There. Is that better?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So this is Bindi. Bindi was a, and this of course is unfortunately what happens a lot is these people have big hearts. So they contacted rescue groups, and this rescue group brought the dog in. I think it was from South America someplace. And they fell in love with Bindi, and so they brought her home. And what happens with most of these dogs is they bond very fast to their primary caretaker, and they don't bond at all to anybody else, at all. So it's like, I'm done. So this is me videotaping, and Bindi, who's a sweet dog, she certainly was not aggressive, but trying to get close enough for a treat without looking at me.
She's taking it back inside.
Look, she'll sit and wave.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give her a treat. She runs off and eats it somewhere and then back.
So they didn't understand her at all.
Hey, Bindi. She eats pretty big can.
Gonna come all the way up again. And take it far away again. If I moved, she'd be gone. I was so still. Oh, look at me. Oh, who are you? Can you see how much of a wild animal look she has about her?
Okay.
And there she is playing ball.
Go get it for me.
Okay, let's see her start to go after the ball here. Does she like to get petted by you guys?
Yes, she does.
To bring it back, but she does not want to bring it back very far. She won't bring it back anywhere near me.
She's just really shame focused.
Yeah.
I beg your pardon? She would bring it back closer, but she certainly doesn't have the capacity for a full retrieve yet. They're working on it, and I think they're probably going to get it. But of course, they wanted to take her places. They wanted to take her camping. They wanted to take her to restaurants. They wanted to take her, you know, just places where people go with their dogs, and she was not cooperating. She wanted to be with them only. She would get in the car and start to shake. She didn't want to go for walks. She'd pull back. She'd pulled out of her harness and out of her collar several times because, as far as she's concerned, every time she left the house, she was leaving her place of comfort and going to someplace very scary and dangerous. And I think I saw them a couple times. They're really nice folks, and they began to realize that they were going to have to adjust their expectations for her, particularly because she's an adult. And that's another thing that people get upset about, because they think, well, you know, the dog is only a year and a half, therefore it's a puppy. No, it's not. And at that point, they're almost reaching adulthood, so you don't have very much time to instill new behaviors in a dog or instill new experiences in a dog. So it was a tough call for them. Nice, nice people, great dog. I, as usual, got really pissed off at the rescue, because the rescues know that they're getting these kinds of dogs in, but they don't tell people. And my working theory right now, or my working, I don't know, hypothesis right now, is that the only people who take dogs that are really going to be difficult all their lives, not necessarily aggressive, maybe like Bindi, are people who are very naive and don't know what they're getting in for. So what we're doing is replacing difficult dogs with innocent people. And it's not fair on either the dogs or the people. That dog should have come to somebody like me, or maybe like you if you're a dog professional. But instead, because we know better, we don't take those dogs.
I have a dog right now that I'm working with that's off the streets of Mexico, and I need to ask them what rescue he came from, but they've had him for 3 years and came to Marin Humane and did a consult, and I need to figure out who gave them the consult because they advised them to come and take a training class. So he's in a family dog one class right now, and he is totally okay with all the other dogs, obviously having been, you know,
raised around dogs.
From where he came from, but extremely human aggressive. So he can't have, and he does a lot of the same behavior. Like, I can't approach him. The only people that he's comfortable with are the people in his family unit pack. They don't have any other dogs in the home, but now what they're saying, they've had him for 3 years, is that when their kids bring their friends over, he's not okay with it.
No.
And it's the same thing. I just think, gosh, like, you know, I really want to take the dog because I know that I could give him the parameters where he would thrive.
He would probably get better with you.
Yeah, but this family is just, like, struggling to try and figure out.
They thought they were getting a pet.
They did.
And they got a project.
And right. They got a wild animal. It does. It's really frustrating to see because they're really trying to do the right thing by the dog, but they just don't have, you know,
they don't have the experience or the tools necessary to do it. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really hard to see.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
So it's something that could be, I don't know if it could be avoided. I mean, you know, there are going to be groups that go to Mexico and get the dogs from Mexico. Compassion Without Borders gets some great dogs from there, as well as some iffy dog.
Right.
The I know Marin Humane got meat dogs.
Yeah.
And some of them were fine, and some of them were not.
Right.
So, you know, that's...
But don't you think, too, because I was thinking, I've obviously been thinking about this dog quite a bit, the most stressful thing for that dog was having been rescued.
Oh, yes.
He's leaving what he's known.
Oh, yeah. It's like somebody from another planet comes and takes one of us, and we're pretty happy with our lives.
Yeah.
And they go, but no, you guys, we have a place that's disease-free.
Yeah.
And so they come and take us. They take us to an alien planet where there are no diseases, but nothing else that's comfortable. And they say, aren't you happier here? And you're going, well, no.
Right.
My family's gone, the people I know are gone, everything about my life is gone. So we think we're rescuing them.
Right.
They think we're kidnapping them.
Right, yeah.
So it's yes, absolutely. And yes, they would probably only live 3 or 4 years. They don't live very long.
Right.
But they might be happy while they're doing that. Mm-hmm. And I think the worst case that I had was a dog that was, they brought him in from Taiwan, sight unseen. So they adopted the dog through a rescue without ever seeing the dog. They met the dog at the airport and took the dog out of the crate there. And she actually was just sitting in the back of the crate. That's all she did. So they took her home in the crate, and they got her in the crate. And 3 days later, she finally came out of the crate. And she came out really slowly. She hadn't eaten anything. She hadn't drunk anything. And they had food and water for her there. And as soon as she'd eat or drink, she'd go back in the crate. And they called me after, I think, the first week or so. And I said, you got to give it 3 weeks because we're not going to be able to go anywhere without 3 weeks. So they did the 3 weeks, and then I went out to see them. By this time, the dog was actually coming out and going around the apartment. But they lived on the third floor. To have the dog go to the bathroom was virtually impossible. They had to pick her up and carry her outside and try to have her go potty. But of course, she didn't want to go potty when anybody else was there, because when a dog urinates or defecates, they put themselves at risk of being prey. So they don't want to do it unless they are feel safe. So they had to find a safe little spot. So there they are carrying around downtown San Francisco. This wasn't out in this is like on Polk Street, you know. And so they kind of got that sort of down. I think they did a potty in the bathroom or something like that. But when I got there, the dog not only would not come out of the crate for me, but sat in the crate and growled. And apparently that was her, that was what she was doing now, is she was starting to growl at people. So it was really terrible. And my recommendation was flat out return the dog to the rescue. So they returned the dog to the rescue, and the rescue got really angry and told them that they were awful people because that they hadn't given this enough of a try. Oh, yes. This happens. They, you know, you take a dog in because you're a good person, and then if you're having problems, they tell you, the Marin Humane used to do this. Before I got there, I don't know if I made the difference, but certainly we helped because we did pre-adopt consults and post-adopt consults and whatnot. But you know, you'd adopt the dog, you'd bring it back three weeks later because it didn't fit, and the person at the front desk would go, oh God, you gave up on this dog. I thought you were adopting this dog forever. And it's not nice to people. And people are our adopters. People, and you're in the dog world, you're not in the dog world, you're in the people world with dogs. You know, because the dogs don't pay us. We love them, but they don't, you know, they don't have anything to do with hiring us, no matter what we do. So yeah, I'm sorry. That really sucks.
It sucks. But I mean, I guess they're doing everything they can by bringing him to...
No, get him out of class.
I agree. I don't know.
Get him out of class. Take him home. Start doing some really slow desensitization, counter conditioning with the dog. Take him places, leave him in the car, let him watch it, look around, act as always a 10-week-old puppy. Start getting nice experiences and realize that he's never going to be normal.
Yeah.
It is not good to take those dogs to classes, you know, because people come up. They don't, you can tell somebody, you can tell. So anybody here have a problem dog? Okay. If you have a problem dog, and maybe with people or with other dogs? Other dogs? Because say it's with other dogs, okay? So you've got this dog, and somebody's coming up to you, and you go, please stop, you know, or put your dog under control. And they go, my dog's friendly.
Oh.
And you go, no, wait a minute.
He just wants to say
hi. Yeah, he just wants to say hi. So all you're saying is, it takes two to be friends. It takes one to be an enemy. So, you know, we've been doing this with Luke forever and ever and ever. It was really, because he's dog aggressive. And I remember one time I was walking with three of my dogs, I think the German Shepherd and probably her and Luke. And some woman was walking her Rottweiler, and we met on the trail, and I moved over to the side of the trail, had the dog sit. Luke, he was really good. When you tell him what to do, he's really good. And she says, oh, can my dog meet your dogs? And I said, no, it's not a good idea. This one's aggressive. And she said, oh, but that's because you have him on leash. And I said, no, he's aggressive. And she said, oh, but this is a female dog. I bet he likes females. I'm like, no, he doesn't like females. And she kept on going on about, you know, how I should let my dog greet her dog who is friendly. And finally, I let Luke turn around. And he went, wah! And she goes, oh, and I said, he's not friendly. And she left. That was like one of the few times that I can actually think, I said something that was good there. But anyway, yeah, it's people are weird. Okay, so back to dogs and wolves. Both wolves and dogs are predators and opportunistic scavengers. So, which means that they will hunt for little mice and rats and stuff like that, and they'll also steal food off your table. That's the way they are. That's what they do, and you can take advantage of that when you're trying to actually, you know, train your dogs or whatever. And I'd already talked about the size of the pack depends on the availability of prey. But it is really important to remember that hunting behavior with all predators, movement sparks the prey drive. So the little dog who I saw last week that the feet, you know, that would go after feet, it's not just that he sees low, but that those feet move in a way that he cannot predict. And as soon as it does, he goes after the feet. So he's not going after a whole person. He's going after the feet of a person because those are moving. So his predatory drive, combined in his case with fear, is causing the behavior problems to actually occur. Hunting has a distinct sequence. It's called the eyestalk. So when an animal is hunting, you know, and we all see this, right? They go the eye, they start looking, then they start stalking, then they chase, catch, kill, eat. So it goes eyestalk, chase, catch, kill, eat, digest, whatever. So that is that's the sequence that we get with all predators, and some dogs more than others. And when we talk about the neotenization again, we'll get into that a little bit more. But the interesting thing about hunting is that it is not a sequence that is motivated by hunger. Even though you would think it would be, it is not. Hunger doesn't have anything to do with it. If they waited until they were hungry to hunt, they would be too weak to catch their prey. So instead of it being motivated by hunger, it's motivated by pleasure. It feels good to catch and chase and catch things. Does that make sense? So so you'll see this in play all the time, right? They do an awful lot of play hunting, and that's practice for hunting, and that's really good. And it's also, play is wonderful because it encourages social attachment and all that kind of stuff as well. But it's really important for us to realize that we can actually use that hunting sequence, and we do use this hunting sequence, to train our dogs, because it is pleasurable to do that. And I remember I had a consult once where I told a guy that his dog, it was an Akita mix, was a predator, and he said, "Oh my God, it sounds like Arnold Schwarzenegger." And I'm like, "No, this is who he is. This is part of who he is. They're predators. They're lovely, wonderful pack animals, and they're predators. So this is a predator." As an African jackal.
It's a rat.
Yes, isn't it? They probably miss 80 to 90%
of the time. Another hunter has a more proactive technique.
And then she goes, boo!
And then she's like, oh.
That was fun, wasn't it? Yeah. Remember I said it's a pleasure sequence? Yeah, it's a pleasure sequence.
She's really not sure what she's doing.
She is hunting them, but it's part of play. But for our purposes, just think about this for a minute. If I started walking up to you with a gun. Just keep on going up to you like with a gun. And then I go, boo! And you're like.
Some moms will say, are okay with this, but she, I felt like if I could see, I was like making noise and I distract her.
Yeah, usually it's a good idea to stop. Yeah. Now, I had a Belgian Tervuren and two Rottweilers, and the Belgian, that's a herding breed. And she would do it, she'd get dropped down, and she would start doing it to Joubert, one of the Rotties. And he'd go, you know, he would be like this.
Yeah,
he gets up because there she is stalking him. And I let her do it with him because he knew. And then she'd get to him and then they'd play. And then they'd start running around. But I never let her do it to anybody else because nobody else knows that she's not going to follow through on the sequence and actually do the capture and bite, right?
She's usually bigger.
Yeah, but you know, so one of my newish clients, she has a dog that will go after small dogs and grab them by the back of the neck. And I said, that's a kill bite. And she goes, well, he doesn't mean that. And I said, no, He may not mean it right now, but when he crunches down one of these times, he's going to go, ah, that was supposed to happen next.
Yeah, he might not have meant it. It's going to happen.
Yeah, so, you know how they used to say the taste of blood and all that kind of stuff? It's not necessarily the taste of blood. It is the eye stalk sequence coming to its natural end. And so you really don't want your dog to do that unless you want your dog to do that.
I stop her.
Yeah, and you stop her, and you can usually stop her with just a teach him a interrupt cue. Or with Ariel, all I used to have to do is kind of go, and she'd turn and stop. It was really fast. But I did think it was funny watching this 120-pound dog getting scared by a 45-pound dog. Like this. Okay. All right, so here's another one. You may have seen this. So this is a pointer. No, that is a picture of a statue of a wolf. Can you see the same thing though happening here? With the music, of course. And they had to actually cut it because it took such a long time. So. Otherwise, people would just kind of go away and not pay any attention to it at all. It's either a wolf or a coyote. Dude. I wonder what's going to happen when he gets all the way up there. No, actually that's a really good point, so we'll come back to that. He's going, there's something wrong with this. But on the other hand, I'll keep going. I think it's probably a drone. Oh, now he's going, oh. Oh. Oh, wow. Okay, so you remember during actually, I don't know if we used it, but during the evaluations, we used the stuffed animal. And I have a lot of video of using, in fact, you'll be seeing the stuffed dog. And the question I'm asked more than anything else is, how come they don't know it's a stuffed dog? And the reason they don't know it's a stuffed dog, well, I don't know, I don't get in their head. But the reason I think they'd think is they will respond to whatever the cue is from whatever sense is sensing them. So if they see something, they're going to believe their vision. If they hear it, they'll believe they're hearing, or if they smell it, they'll believe they're smelling. So when their eyes are filled with dog, even though their nose is saying that's not a dog, they have a tendency to believe, because they're going to be conservative about it, right? So they have a tendency then to believe that it is the dog as opposed to that it's a real dog as opposed to a fake dog. Yeah. Then they get all the way up there and they go, oh God, this is embarrassing.
Yeah, I've had that happen so many times. Yeah. I used to train guide dogs and would always go to Grinnelly Square area.
Right.
And there's some of those shops that, like, I call the Michael Jackson shops where they have, like, the fake.
Oh, yeah, and yeah, yeah.
The chandeliers. And there's one that always had a line out front, and I always tried to work it off past it, because half the time
it's very difficult to do it. Yeah, they didn't want to.
I think that was some kind of a frozen something they didn't know what. So yeah. Just to see their reaction.
Well, we're naturally inclined to be afraid of what we do not know. And so that is particularly with a mannequin or something, it either doesn't move at all or it moves in a really weird way. So actually at Marine Humane Society, they have these dog sculptures. And half the dogs will walk past it and go, whoa, what is that? Or the really fearful dogs will just stop and they don't want to go anywhere. And then they get all the way up and they do some investigation and then they start feeling embarrassed and then they go on, you know. And I truly feel that embarrassment is something the dogs feel. So this is a poodle. This is one of my clients. She's a poodle. He's a poodle. And she finds it very hard to take him for a walk because he's always hunting mice. And the reason he's always hunting mice is because he caught some. So now he knows that he's successful at that. So he has, and the little black thing he's got on his head is called a fox pro, or an out fox. Out fox. You got a mouse. The out fox is for foxtails.
And he gets mice even with that on?
Yeah, he'll kill them, but he can't eat them, which is nice. Oh. Got it!
Don't bring it.
Bring it here, honey!
Just leave it.
People think of poodles as being kind of just, you know, poof dogs or whatever. They're hunting dogs. They're definitely hunting dogs. Okay.